everyone, you're listening to The Forum, where science comes to socialize. We hope you enjoyed our first three episodes a couple weeks ago, and thanks for coming back today and joining us for a discussion that will certainly be relevant to all of our listeners. Don't forget to tweet us at ISGPTweets, hashtag ISGPForum, with your opinions. Chatting it up with me today will be Barbara and Cleo. My name's Aubrey. Let's get started.
Well, you really hit the nail on the head when you said today's podcast topic will be relevant to all of our listeners.
Very much so, regardless of age, gender, ethnicity, sexual orientation, or pretty much any other category, everyone is susceptible to infection with the influenza virus.
That's right, folks. Today we will be talking a lot about one of the most common afflictions sending school-aged kids to the nurse's office and debilitating full dormitories of college students at a time, the flu.
The flu has become an interesting issue, not just because we see it on our favorite news channels annually, but because there's actually a vaccine for it.
So some of the controversy involves the efficacy and usage pattern of the vaccine.
What do you mean by the usage pattern?
Well, specifically, I'm thinking of what percentage of a given population is using it. I mean, the beauty of a vaccine is that, theoretically, if enough people use it, then the disease's incidence can be supremely reduced in that population. Consider it immunity by association.
But somehow we still end up with swine flu scares and sniffling children being sent home from school at astonishing rates, especially during the winter months. I mean, my mom's a teacher, and she'll tell me how almost a third of the sixth grade class will be absent on any given day when flu season rolls around.
Improvements in vaccination efforts and protocols specifically targeting the influenza virus were a topic of discussion at the Institute on Science for Global Policy's first ever academic partnership conference, or as we call them, IAP conferences. IAP conferences are held at academic institutions and engage undergraduate students in both conference planning and debating.
The first IAP conference ever was hosted at my undergraduate institution, Ursinus College in Collegeville, Pennsylvania.
If I didn't know you, Aubrey, I wouldn't believe that place actually existed. I mean, a town called Collegeville?
I promise it exists. We even have our own exit sign off the highway.
Okay, if you say so. But that's besides the point.
Okay. So Ursinus was the first school to commit to ISGP's IAP program. And to learn more about the program, you should definitely check out our website. What I will tell you is this. It's a great experience for the undergrads who actually take a semester-long course to plan the conference, edit the presenter's papers, and, most importantly, master the material that will help them be expert debaters on conference day.
Ursinus's first IAP conference was held in April of 2014 and was titled Focus on Pandemic Preparedness. As such, it was part of the ISGP's Emerging and Persistent Infectious Diseases Signature Series.
The paper we'll discuss today in the context of combating the flu was written by Dr. George Korch, a senior science advisor within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Planning for the Next Pandemic was the paper's title, so check it out online.
Before we get started, let's tackle some terminology that's going to come up quite a bit today. We've all heard of H1N1, H5N1, H7N9, or some other weird combination of H's, N's, and numbers when listening to someone talk about the flu.
Right, and we've heard about the swine flu, avian flu. What's it all mean?
Well, H and N stand for hemagglutinin and neuraminidase, respectively, which are two classes of proteins appearing on the surface of the flu virus. According to the CDC, there are 18 subtypes of the H protein and 11 types of N, so flu viruses can have different combinations of these H and N subtypes. And voila, you have your fancy H1N1 or H7N9 labels. These can act like a virus's fingerprint and help identify which flu strain it is.
And flu strains can be dubbed avian flu or swine flu or whatnot in everyday language because those strains either originate in or resemble strains found in those types of animals.
Now that we've gotten that out of the way, Dr. Korch began his discussion by expressing concern over the fact that new flu strains pose great risks to both human and animal health, citing an H5N1 outbreak in humans back in 1997, as well as the more recent H7N9 outbreak in China with even higher mortality.
It turned out that H7N9 strain first showed up in birds, but had been slowly adapting to infect mammals.
These types of flus are called zoonotic diseases, or zoonoses. And yes, that is zoo, like animals in the zoo, which means the viruses are passed from animals to humans.
What I found interesting was that Dr. Korch correlated recent outbreaks in humans and domestic chickens with increased prosperity in Asian countries.
Well, that's no fun. You've improved your annual income. You get to eat some chicken, only to get sick.
Well, I don't think it works quite like that, but the correlation does make sense. In just over 10 years, China's poultry industry has expanded rapidly, resulting in a pretty large avian host population.
And when you pair that with a rapidly expanding human population, well, mathematical probability tells you this is a recipe for disaster.
Well, did you know that annual flu epidemics cause $10 billion in direct medical costs? And that number swells to $87 billion globally when you consider the total economic impact?
I had no idea. With such statistics and the chance of outbreaks increasing, it's a wonder that flu vaccination rates in both the U.S. and abroad are relatively low.
Especially since, among debaters, it was widely agreed that vaccines are the best public health tool that we have to combat the flu. But herd immunity needs to be established for the potential of this tool to be fully realized.
If vaccines are the best weapons we have, then we should be really shocked at the low rate of vaccination amongst healthcare workers specifically.
Yeah, Dr. Korch reprimanded the example set by healthcare workers in regards to this issue. How can we expect the public to buy into the vaccination effort if only 20 to 30% of workers in the healthcare sector are immunized?
That statistic is really crazy and a bit disconcerting.
So maybe it's not so surprising that the general public is reluctant to vaccinate against the flu?
Well, Dr. Korch says that the reasons for low vaccination rates in the public are wide-ranging and include skewed perceptions of vaccine safety, disbelief that you'll actually contract a severe case of the flu, and uncertainty regarding the vaccine's efficacy.
Don't citizens have a right to be suspicious of efficacy, though? I mean, the effectiveness of the flu vaccine really depends on what viral strain is prevalent that year, as well as the individual's age.
It doesn't seem to just be a question of efficacy, though. The debaters seem to think that an incomplete understanding of how serious the flu actually is prevents many people from taking the vaccination seriously.
Which corresponds with the debaters' belief that more people would feel a sense of urgency about getting a flu vaccine if the mortality rate from seasonal flu reached that of H5N1, 40 or 50%. That's a pretty scary MO, if you ask me.
So how can we achieve a better understanding of all things flu within the public? The debaters acknowledge that government-funded education campaigns through avenues like the CDC's website have launched. Have they been effective?
I mean, it's hard to say. While the information provided on these sites is accurate and understandable, not everyone has internet access or even knows that these resources exist.
I think the debaters decided that additional education efforts would be beneficial.
No surprise there.
Definitely not, though they did give us some specifics, like creating avenues that use a variety of dissemination tactics with the goal of encouraging flu vaccination.
But if we succeed and drastically increase vaccination rates, there's a whole slew of new issues we'd have to deal with, like getting fast regulatory approval on new varieties, or even just ensuring that the vaccines were properly distributed.
You're right. And the debaters talked a lot about how the swine flu outbreak in 2009 has been used as a case study to address these issues. For instance, even though the FDA takes a lot of heat for moving too fast or too slow in many regulatory decisions, it gained the authority to fast-track approvals in outbreak settings.
Right, and that's important because the FDA is the main regulatory agency for things like vaccines in the U.S., but they could still benefit from new frameworks that would allow them to quickly establish clinical trials of new antivirals or other drugs during a pandemic event.
Fall of 09, junior year of high school, I totally had swine flu.
Really?
Yeah.
Were you vaccinated?
No.
Nice one.
It's okay, Aubrey, I had it too.
You two are walking examples of what the debaters were discussing.
Moving right along, since I feel Cleo's judgment, I want to get back to the FDA regulatory issue for a second. The debaters weren't totally convinced that hastened regulatory approval in pandemic preparedness efforts is always a good idea.
That's true. They brought up the case of Tamiflu, in which the U.S. government spent over $1 billion to stockpile the drug, only to later find that Tamiflu is ineffective in combating pandemic flu.
Well, yeah, looking back, that action looks a little impulsive on the part of the government, but I'm sure that if Tamiflu had been effective, the effort would have been praised.
Valid point, which demonstrates the fact that policy decisions concerning pandemic preparedness are based on a cost-benefit analysis. It's not easy to predict the future, and at some point a decision has to be made.
I guess it comes down to the debater's point that accomplishing both rapid regulatory approval and investigations into efficacy and safety is a major balancing act.
Can't argue with that. So let's switch gears here and talk about another reality that Dr. Korch addressed.
All right, we can chat about the fact that until recently, around, 2006-ish, there was nearly zero flu vaccine production within the United States, almost a complete standstill. This occurred because companies realized that flu vaccines weren't where the money was at. Blockbuster drugs were the golden ticket.
Wait, can we get an example here of a blockbuster drug? Because right now I'm picturing Benedict Cumberbatch in pill form.
Well, you're a little off. Blockbuster drugs are just super popular pharmaceuticals that are used by many people. So many people, in fact, that a single blockbuster drug usually generates at least $1 billion annually.
Ah, makes more sense now.
Yes, well, establishment of the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, aka BARDA, because that name is a mouthful, really turned things around.
Yeah, since BARDA's creation, many new flu vaccines have been created here, as well as novel vaccine development technologies.
Like the ability to make vaccines within cells rather than eggs, so that people with egg allergies have no excuse not to be vaccinated.
Developments like that have definitely expanded the reach and utility of flu vaccines. Another is antiretroviral drugs that can be used to treat pandemic flu in people who are particularly susceptible, plus difficult to treat. People that are severely ill, hospitalized, or the elderly, for instance.
And BARDA supported that antiretrovirals program, as well as efforts to facilitate flu vaccine production in developing countries.
There are actually global efforts to help less affluent nations be able to produce flu vaccines for their own people.
And Dr. Korch was really into the idea of continuing to improve manufacturing infrastructure worldwide. He said so in his first policy issue.
He hoped that the World Health Organization, along with developed nations, could lead the way in making global manufacturing a reality to improve vaccine access. He also cited the WHO's goal of having 500 million flu vaccine dosages produced by the end of 2015.
Having that many vaccines available would certainly improve access. I guess time will tell if the goal is to be reached.
But it was acknowledged that vaccines aren't our only hope. In fact, Dr. Korch would like to see investments in a diverse suite of antivirals to reduce the inherent risk of antiviral resistance in common flu strains.
Additionally, new treatment strategies with fancy names like neuraminidase inhibitors are in development. Well, it's actually not that fancy. Our listeners should totally understand that terminology now since we schooled them in flu jargon.
But to those who might have forgotten, neuraminidase is referring to the N in H1N1 and the like.
But you're right, Cleo. The debaters were in agreement that the best flu pandemic prevention strategy would incorporate both vaccines and these new fancy name technologies. It might cost more money since these newer options require further development, but it's the best solution overall.
And Dr. Korch really pulls us all back down to earth when he mentions that, despite all of this progress, we are far from significantly reducing the flu's effects on the human population.
Yeah, he lays out a ton of areas in which we need to improve, including, but definitely not limited to, improving access to vaccines and public understanding of their importance.
The debaters were keen to pick up on the access issue, but not just in terms of physical access. They seem more concerned about the monetary barrier that prevents lower-income individuals from getting vaccines and other prevention help.
So true. Even in programs where vaccine price is reduced, $5 or $10 might be a significant amount of money to spend for a family.
Yeah, if you have to choose between dinner and a flu vaccine, you're probably going to choose food.
It was pointed out, however, that in emergency situations, those in need have less hoops to jump through in order to get vaccinated. This, despite the fact that paperwork and waiting periods can make signing up for assistance programs a tedious process.
Speaking of waiting periods, a lot of Dr. Korch's critiques of the flu management system are temporally related. In other words, we don't benefit from saying, hey look, half of Asia has this new strain of the flu. Let's figure out how to vaccinate against it.
Right. It's critical to be able to identify a new strain before it becomes a pandemic, so we can find ways to vaccinate for it before it's a widespread problem.
And right now, that's an area in which we could improve. Another area involves virus transmission and how we can more effectively use horizontal measures to counter disease spread.
And what are these horizontal measures exactly?
Well, a great example that Dr. Korch uses is the N95 mask, which is basically a face mask intended to prevent the user from being infected by airborne or liquid contaminants. Horizontal measures in general aim to prevent transmission of a wide range of diseases, while vertical measures are single pathogen specific.
So a vaccine would be an example of a vertical measure.
Exactly. So Dr. Korch wants to see both vertical and horizontal measure development. While he likes the idea of face masks, he wants to see new respiratory protection devices created that are both reusable and easier to wear.
If a tool like this was mass-produced, it could be made immediately available to the public and in the event of a sudden outbreak.
Along these lines, Dr. Korch identifies many areas of research in need of bolstering. Disease transmission patterns, both human-to-human and animal-to-human, comprise one of these areas.
And he thinks that the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, should be making this research area a priority.
The debaters seem to think that the priority research area should be developing tests that can more quickly identify flu strains. This outcome would depend on having a solid understanding of how a disease operates or manifests at the early infection stages.
Well, the quicker we recognize that there's a pathogen in our midst, the better, I suppose. So that makes sense.
Dr. Korch also wants research to target a universal flu vaccine, something that we've never actually seen in practice. For those of you who aren't aware, flu vaccines are developed such that they protect against one or a few particular strains of the flu.
One or a few combinations of H's and N's, in other words.
Right. So the elusive and, at this point, theoretical, universal flu vaccine would find a way to target as many flu strains as possible. So, as many H's and N's with one administration. Or it would provide long-lasting immunity.
Longer than a year.
Right. And Dr. Korch says that governments should fund this effort as an investment in developing immune persistence and herd immunity. Not to mention that it would hopefully result in less money being spent annually on damage control after outbreaks occur.
Speaking of herd immunity, a surprising amount of debate time was dedicated to another social factor in preventing disease spread.
You're right. The debaters latched onto the idea of social distancing practices in the face of pandemic disease. In other words, they discussed the concept of keeping individuals out of the school or workplace when they're contagious.
Studies have shown that these strategies are, in fact, effective at mitigating disease spread. But people are often unwilling to comply since missing a day of work often results in a loss of productivity or income.
I'm not going to lie, I was one of those kids who only missed school when I physically couldn't get out of bed. It's more work missing school than it is to be there.
So this is exactly why there's a problem with social isolation. The debaters agreed that there needs to be some concept of social responsibility taught to parents, schools, and other community hubs so that social distancing is effective in disease outbreak scenarios.
And when you talk about the flu in a social context, it begs the question, can we make flu vaccines mandatory, especially since the herd immunity depends on maximum societal compliance?
Don't we already require vaccines for children in schools?
I know I was required to fill out an immunization chart recently when I started grad school, and we weren't allowed to register for classes until the campus health center approved our medical records.
But guys, we're talking about flu vaccines here. The flu is pretty different from polio. There's a different level of risk.
Is the level of risk different, or is it the perceived level of risk? It's pretty common to get the flu every year, especially if you're in a highly socialized environment like a school.
That's an interesting point, but the debaters were concerned that making flu vaccines mandatory would cause public animosity against the government because, let's face it, people don't really like being told what to do.
Especially when it's the government telling them what to do for some reason.
The debaters pointed out that if this animosity did result from a flu vaccine mandate, it would actually cause less people to get vaccines, somewhat out of spite.
Would that happen, though? I mean, if public schools said students couldn't come to class without a flu shot, would parents really put up that much of a fight?
Well, parents can and do get their kids exempted in a lot of cases, even for some of the disease immunizations that we consider more important, the ones that are currently mandatory.
Yes, but the reason those exemptions are considered quote-unquote okay in most cases is because basically all of the other kids have been immunized and we've established the herd immunity we've been talking about.
Which we haven't necessarily achieved for the flu.
So maybe it's time for our listeners to weigh in. Do you think that flu vaccines should be mandatory? If so, where? Schools? Offices? Everywhere?
Do you have an idea regarding how vaccines can be better distributed globally? Who should take charge of this effort?
We want to hear your thoughts on these issues, plus anything else we've talked about here today. Check out the full summary of Dr. Korch's debate from the Ursinus IAP conference by visiting our website, clicking on the Publications tab, and searching for our book on pandemic preparedness.
Then tweet us your thoughts at ISGPTweets, hashtag ISGPForum.
Hope you enjoyed socializing with science today. See you next time.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.